Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Jeff Weiss, whose new collection of stories is called How, and Ruth Salvaggio, whose new book is Hearing Sappho in New Orleans, The Call of Poetry from Congo Square to the Ninth Ward. Jeff Weiss is a native of Peoria, Illinois, who's been living and teaching in New Orleans since 1993. Jeff's first novel, Tiny Clubs, was published in 2007. His new book, How, a Collection of Short Stories, won the Ohio State University Prize in Short Fiction and has recently been published. These are amazing stories, sharp and funny and distinctive and new. Many of them are set in New Orleans, and some are set in a high school called Our Lady of Perpetual Succor. All of them are fresh and unforgettable. Welcome to The Reading Life, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I remember when your first novel, Tiny Clubs, was published and saying, I couldn't wait to see what you did next. Well, thanks. I mean, this is great.
Yeah, I think it's pretty different.
Very much so. Tell us about How. That's a pretty provocative title.
Yeah, well, what is it? Two or three of the stories in the collection start with that word in the title. And those are kind of voice exercises that I guess I was thinking of. You know, the classic story answers the question about how something happened or how something is done. And so I just started playing with possible titles, odd titles that I thought would answer questions that nobody would actually ask. And the stories that I wrote, which tend to be shorter voice exercises in response to those questions, all begin with that word. And so that's the kind of repeating element in the book.
So tell us a bit about Mr. Gary Wilkins, who teaches English at Our Lady of Perpetual Succor.
Certainly is an alter ego, as are a number of the people in those stories, I think. You know, I think people who have taught with me are going to recognize some of the people in those stories. And so those stories give me a chance to kind of do things in the alter ego that I would never do and say things I would never say. And I think, you know, he's in some ways a lot worse than I am and in some ways probably better as well. So it's a way of, I think, working out some fantasies and negative fantasies and what-ifs that I, you know, have thought of over my years of working in high schools.
Now, a lot of these stories deal with, you know, I hate to say it, but incredibly unpleasant things. And sometimes the stories turn on a dime and unpleasant things become changed into something really meaningful. A man falls in love with an incredibly angry woman in arms.
Yes. There's no reasonable explanation why he should want to stay with her in that story, but he does, and it has, I think he decides more to do with him ultimately than it does with her.
And then in this procedure, talks about the removal of resentment as if it were a physical object.
It's based on an impossible sort of metaphor, as if you could, remove a personality characteristic with a scalpel or a hatchet or a gun or whatever else is used. I think a Balkan auger at one point is used in that story.
I just love it. It's one of my favorites. And How to Be a Better You. That's another story. I mean, we are all awash in advice about how to be a better you. But I love it when the object of this lecture is told they have very, very poor mouse skills. Mm-hmm. That was one of my favorite moments in this story.
Yeah, that probably is an annoyance of mine from watching people try to work the mouse at work. Yeah, that story, I think, is about looking at yourself and thinking about how seemingly easy it would be to improve. I mean, I could list all the ways that I could be a better person. I know what they are. I'm just not willing to make those changes. I think people are what they are, in part by fate, but in part by choice. You know, I could make myself a better person pretty easily. And that story is sort of playing with the idea of telling yourself those things.
Many of these stories exist in a world that's going to be kind of familiar to New Orleans readers, because it's a world that's riddled with Catholicism. And that's very important to some of these stories, that difference between the sacred and the profane, the life of the body and the life of the spirit.
I'm not Catholic, but I've taught in Catholic schools for 17 years. And so I guess I'm kind of Catholic in that way. Certainly all of those issues are things that I've thought really carefully about, maybe, I don't want to say more carefully, but very carefully as an outsider, as they're discussed in religious terms. And that dichotomy, the sacred and the profane, the mind and the body, is, I don't think we're ever going to get past that. It's so interesting to think across those borders, and that's probably, in fact, what many of these stories are about on the deepest level.
Right.
Is trying to think about that, and that also goes back to the life of a teacher. You know, so much of the life of a teacher is so profane and bodied and sweaty and material and
right.
bad smelling and hot and close and all of that. But then also, you know, the part that makes teaching worth it are the things you can do with people. You know, on the level of spirit and the inspiration of it and the motivation of it and all of those things. I mean, you wouldn't continue teaching if you really believed that there was only the body and everything
right.
was material. And yet everything is. So, you know, I don't know how to explain that, but it's a fascinating problem or question.
But people do forget that teaching is such physical labor. And they do forget that students are changing all the time, you know, especially teenagers.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know who they are when they wake up in the morning. You know,
no.
and they look in the mirror and they're different every day. It's
right.
an amazing time. Now, the collection concludes with a lovely New Orleans set story called Saints and Martyrs. And, you know, I think if you move to New Orleans, you can be a Midwesterner, you can be a Texan. You're going to move here and you're going to become a little bit Catholic, no
yeah.
matter what. So that's a post-Katrina story.
Yes.
Too.
Yeah, it's the only direct writing I've ever done about that, and I'm pretty sure the only direct writing I'll do about it. I mean, without even thinking about it, decided that was not for me to write about. Further, I think New Orleans is really difficult to write about well. And that's another topic that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I decided I would not try to tackle head on as a non-native, because it's so hard not to, it's hard to think about the city in ways that aren't cliched, you know. So that story was really hard to write, and a lot of the atmosphere of it and the feelings of it capture what I felt after the storm, which was a kind of difficult period for me. And so the story was really hard to write. It must have gone through 40 or 50 drafts and been abandoned five or six different times, and I had no idea where it was going. And even thinking about that story now kind of exhausts me, mm-hmm. Thinking about the writing of it, but then also the time after Katrina, the looking for a new job and the coming back and all the rest of that.
Yeah, that one line, when will someone be along to pick up the trash?
Yeah.
That kind of cosmic exhaustion everybody felt.
Right. And I still feel that when I think mm-hmm. back about that.
But I think, you know, one of the great things about what you're doing is that in these stories, New Orleans is a fact of life. You know, and you've captured what the facts are about living here in so many ways. I wonder if you'd read a little bit for us from one of them.
Sure. I'm going to read two paragraphs from the second story, which is Child of God. And this is one that takes place in a high school. And in this story, the narrator is Gary Wilkins. And his favorite student, named Ashley, has gotten pregnant. And the question is whether they're going to make her leave and go to the alternative school or not. And the narrator does not want her to have to leave. She shouldn't have to leave. But another teacher, a religion teacher, wants her off campus. And so this is after school. One day, the narrator is trying to find out whether, in fact, she's been sent away. And the other teacher, the religion teacher's name is Ted Infante. He's just mentioned in the last sentence that I'm going to read here. After Ashley's class, fifth period, the rest of the day was a dullness and a drudge. I had two more sections of senior English, but they were non-honors, which means that far from a quickening of the mind that leaves the body receding to a vanishing point, I could look forward to repeating myself with heavy eyelids, performing broad, senseless gestures to compel attention, and using my face as a weapon of surveillance and deterrence. Every day of teaching involves at least one episode of conscious sweating. It happens at cafeteria duty with the humid chewing of 500 mouths around you, or when your arm is lodged in the guts of an overheated copier and you need double-sided quizzes for a class that starts in 5 minutes. This is the key to the unique exhaustion of teaching. The mind is called upon to do delicate work inside a constantly jostled container, like a painter made to paint inside a lurching public bus. At the bell, I humped my 12 pounds of books through the shouldery mosh of the hallway to the locker of sophomore Nick Melville, where in a finely modulated light yell that only he could hear, I got him to admit that he had cheated on a test. Then, learning from a secretary that Doug Johansson, our assistant principal, had gone outside to watch football practice, I trekked across the blazing sward and, with the sun glinting directly into my brain, nudged the conversation with surgically cool disinterest until I learned that we had indeed decided to send Ashley away to the alternative school without delay, precisely because of her prominence on campus. Then I had to write a letter of recommendation for a surpassingly average student, a task requiring a mastery of faint adjectives and motionless verbs, a discipline much more demanding than actual praise, and I had to do so in a hard plastic chair produced in numbers too large for an attention to ergonomics, and with a monitor whose blurriness I had to squint to correct, in a building that had begun to slow cook its contents now that the janitors had turned off the air conditioner. By the time I was licking the triplicate envelopes and signing across the seals, I could smell a uric, vaguely bookish reek coming off me. Then at 6 o'clock, I sat down at my desk, shut my stinging eyes, and turned my mind to destroying Ted Infante once and for all.
I know so many teachers who are going to read that and go, yes. You work hard over there at Jesuit, don't you?
Yeah, although the stories that are set in high schools, I wrote before I was at Jesuit. I went to Jesuit after the storm. And so really the people who will recognize that setting and atmosphere are the people who went to Archbishop Hannon.
Right. That's where you were before.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Jeff Weiss, whose wonderful new collection of short stories is called How. You can meet him Saturday, June 23rd at 1 o'clock at Garden District Bookshop. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Susan.
Ruth Salvaggio is a native New Orleanian who grew up in the Ninth Ward. Now she's a professor of English and American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But that New Orleans sensibility sings through every line of her new book, Hearing Sappho in New Orleans, The Call of Poetry from Congo Square to the Ninth Ward. Hello, Ruth.
Hello, Susan.
Welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me.
This book had its origin in what we call a Katrina moment, didn't it?
It absolutely did. I can't imagine it existing without Katrina, sadly enough.
So describe that moment, would you?
Sure.
Because it's one I think so many people will identify with.
Right. Basically happened was I had just left New Orleans a couple of weeks before Katrina was passing through the bottom part of Florida. So it was really almost on its way, certainly into the Gulf. Then, of course, I'm up here in North Carolina beginning to get all the news. And when disaster struck, when I really got the news about the break in the 17th Street Canal, especially having a little house in Lakeview, you can imagine, I thought, oh boy, this is really something. And then I just went into panic, as everyone else did, though I was not in the city at the time, and I had left a couple of weeks before. But the result was that I thought all I could do was try to write about it. I really didn't know what I was writing about. And along the way, as I continued with this writing, after the immediacy of the disaster passed, when I was into the writing about maybe, goodness, several months, I realized that I was tracking a poetic voice in the city that kept recurring again and again in the face of tragedy, and that this poetic voice had a very long history. And that's how Katrina got me going on this long poetic voyage down there.
And so began your journey. It took you back to the early, early writings of the Creoles, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It took me all the way back to the founding of the city, or at least the so-called claiming of the city by the French in 1718. First slave ships arrived in 1719. And pretty soon, one starts hearing stories about gatherings at a place that would come to be known as Congo Square or the place Congo. So it went back at least that far. And then even farther back in time to some of the chants of indigenous cultures that populated that area for thousands of years before Europeans ever arrived. So it went back a long way.
And one of the ideas that informs the writing of this book is that idea of the long song, which you took from musician Sidney Bechet. Describe what that means for us.
I came across Sidney Bechet's idea of the long song when I was well in process with the book, not even realizing at that moment I was writing so much about the poetry of the city, and suddenly everything clicked. What Bechet said was that as a jazz musician, he was always urged on by this phenomenon known as the long song. And it's long because it stretches back in time. And his reference was probably to his father and grandfather and so forth. He doesn't mention his mother's, who probably sang the song in the early days of the African slave trade and therefore in Congo Square. And what I do is acknowledge that wonderful insight of his, but I also discover that New Orleans is the conveyor, actually, of a longer song than that. And I take it back in time all the way to the ancient Mediterranean world, hence the emergence of Sappho in the book and her fragments. And I track it back into what some literary critics call deep time, because it goes beyond centuries, and indeed it goes back a couple of millennia in this case. And it gets at the heart of what lyric poetry is all about.
And this long song for you is not only a kind of memory, but a discovery as well, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You hear it, but you may not know what it is. And then you have to go back to it, and you see that it's a song you always hear coming from behind you, but it keeps recurring because it's a necessary song. And usually it is a song about how to establish our bonds with each other in the face of disaster. And that's the song that New Orleans takes from the ancient world, that song of bonding, that where a poet and a singer is always calling out to someone else. And that's why you can't really just remember it. It keeps echoing, but it's echoing before you ever get the chance to sing it. Mm-hmm. So it precedes what you're about to say and informs it in a certain way. It's like history, but it's lyrical.
And one of your lovely, lovely descriptions is that way in which the second line is like a long song with one foot stepping forward and a body leaning back.
Yes.
I thought that was really, really perfect.
Right. And actually, I took that from another critic who described the actual movement. But anyone who's seen bodies in movement in a second line will know that swaying movement and that kind of step, or even if you watch a jazz funeral just beginning, you know, and the foot hitting the ground and a little movement back and then forward. And it embodies, I think, the whole dynamic of this long song.
Well, everybody I've mentioned it to has totally gotten it when I've given them that example. It just works. Now, you brought this idea forward to works by contemporary poets, including former State Poet Laureate Brenda Marie Osby, Catherine Sonia, Gina Ferrara, Nicole Cooley. Were these all writers you'd been reading all along? How did that part of the writing work?
The only writer I had been reading all along and had talked frequently was, of course, the former Poet Laureate of Louisiana, Brenda Marie Osby. I knew her work fairly well, and I think she's an astonishing poet who is also so powerfully drawn into the history of the city. It's as if all of her poetry, in fact, is informed by this sort of long song which she produces in her own lyric expression. But the others, some of them I knew. I knew Catherine Sonia's poetry, but others I didn't. And I had to go, you know, flip through a lot of books that came out, John Travis's work that he publishes, you know, readings at the Maple Leaf, though I had often gone to readings at the Maple Leaf myself. Other poets, Nicole Cooley's book, which of course came out after Katrina, her book entitled Breach, and is about the post-Katrina landscape of the city. So many, if not most, I discovered after I began writing and started looking into the contemporary scene of poetry, because, of course, I wanted to make a link, which really exists, between the oldest poetic expression of the city and its nurturance and sustenance all the way on through our own time.
One of the other things that I love about this book is the way you so evocatively capture the rituals of renewal after Katrina. You know, the first reading at the Maple Leaf Bar, the Mardi Gras Indians coming back into the streets. It's just that return of the kind of poetry that only New Orleans offers.
Yes. And, you know, it's a funny thing. I was inspired by something I heard on television, and I cannot remember the musician who was being interviewed, but whoever he was, and he was one of the many famous musicians in the city, he looked into the camera and said, "We will bring this city back one song at a time." And that stuck with me as I wrote the book. And I saw New Orleans always bringing itself and the people who are bonded in it, bringing them back together, always through some sort of lyric expression. And that's how that all got started.
Well, I love this book. I especially love your image of New Orleans as a woman with a crazy heart.
Thanks.
Yes. I know. So many wonderful images of women all throughout the book. And I think many New Orleans writers and readers will find their love of the city reflected and celebrated here. We've been talking with Ruth Salvaggio, the author of Hearing Sappho in New Orleans, The Call of Poetry from Congo Square to the Ninth Ward. Thanks for being here, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
You can meet Ruth Thursday, June 21st at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thank you. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Leonard Pitts signs his novel Freeman, Thursday, June 21st at 5:30 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Ruth Salvaggio, discusses and signs Hearing Sappho in New Orleans, The Call of Poetry from Congo Square to the Ninth Ward, Thursday, June 21st at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. She also reads Sunday, June 24th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. Rosalind Story signs Wading Home, Thursday, June 21st from 6:30 to 8 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Rain Dugasse Bouton, an English professor at Southeastern Louisiana University in Hammond, will lead a free two-hour workshop on travel writing at 7 p.m. Thursday, June 21st at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Participants should bring a photo from one of their travel adventures and begin drafting an essay that will capture the excitement of the experience. For more information about this, contact Chris Smith at the library at 504-889-8143 or wcsmith@jefferson.lib.la.us. There will be a special screening of writer William Joyce's Oscar-winning animated film, The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore, Friday, June 22nd at 6 p.m. at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, sponsored by Octavia Books. I'll be interviewing Bill Joyce about his inspirations for the film after the showing. For ticket info, check out octaviabooks.com. Today's guest, Jeff Weiss, signs his short story collection, How, Saturday, June 23rd from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. R.J. Smith signs The One, The Life and Music of James Brown, Tuesday, June 26th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. And coming up, the Bayou Soul Writers Conference, which was begun by novelist Clarence Nero last year, is back for a second outing July 5th through 6th at the Holiday Inn downtown in the New Orleans Public Library. Among the impressive list of headliners are Omar Tyree, Victoria Christopher Murray, Mary Monroe, Julie Kane, Jed Horn, and Victor Laval. For more information and to register, check out bswconference.com. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org or email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading. ¶¶